This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. For over a century, New Englanders sailed the globe, spending months away from home in unimaginable conditions in search of whales. The payoff then was blubber, oil, ivory, and baleen. Today, commercial whaling is confined to just three small countries, but there are still those who spend their lives searching for whales. They're scientists in search of data and understanding. Now a new collection at the New Bedford Whaling Museum shares the life's work of one such whale researcher, Dr. William Watkins. He was an anthropologist with a knack for electronics who found his niche at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Over the course of his career, he compiled the world's largest collection of whale, dolphin, and seal sounds. Those recordings, along with Watkins' publications and research equipment, comprise the William Watkins Collection, now the property of the New Bedford Whaling Museum. And with me here in our Woods Hole studio is Christina Connett, curator of exhibitions and collections at New Bedford Whaling Museum, also William Rocha, director of K-12 and science programs at the museum. And later this hour, we'll be joined by Peter Tyack, professor in the School of Biology and the Scottish Ocean Institute at the University of St. Andrews. Welcome to both of you.
Good morning.
Thank you.
We also invite you to join our conversation. Our toll-free phone number is 866-999-4626. You can send email to livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Just look for Living Lab Radio. We will, of course, talk about the William Watkins collection and hear a bit of it as well this hour. But, Robert, I actually want to start with a study that was released recently that you read that puts perhaps the best number to date on the impact of whaling, the total number of whales killed by humans, at least through commercial whaling, during the 20th century. How did you put that together and what did you find?
We used a combination of the database that's maintained by the International Whaling Commission. And then one of the co-authors on the paper, Dr. Yulia Ivashenko, who's originally from about an hour north of Moscow, she knows the whaling industry well, she knows the language well, and she was able to go through what in many ways were secret documents kept by many of the researchers on the Russian whaling ships, and she was able to get the accurate whaling totals as opposed to what the Soviets were reporting to the IWC. So taking all of those numbers, we came up with the total of nearly 2.9 million large whales, and that excludes things like orcas, belugas, you know, other things that might have been taken for food or just because they were there or whatever, you know.
One of the things that jumped out to me in reading the coverage of the story and looking at the study is that, of course, this is 20th century, the 1900s, and we're talking about close to 3 million whales.
Right.
And one graph that I saw of how many whales were taken of species by species, things like right whales aren't even in there. This is already kind of the decline of whaling, not even the heyday, not even looking at the 1800s. I think it's kind of shocking to realize how recently we were still on a really broad scale. Of course, you know, there are still a few countries that whale commercially, but how broadly we were still whaling on a commercial basis into the 20th century.
True. And what is the biggest difference between whaling in the 1800s, whaling in the 1900s? Whaling in the 1800s, they were limited to right whales, sperm whales, humpbacks, bowheads. The 1900s, because of new technology, they were going after species that hadn't been hunted, which left quite a few, you know, 2.9 million to be caught. And you had commented about barely even seeing a blip on the graph of the right whales, because, they had been hunted pretty heavily during the 1800s, but they were still caught, but not like we saw with fin and sperm and the other species.
Christina Connett, it's the New Bedford Whaling Museum. We don't commercially whale here anymore, and I think we tend to think, oh, well, we're going to go to the museum and see our past history. But with things like the William Watkins Collection, you're kind of moving into the modern era, a new chapter in our relationship with whales. How much do you see the museum kind of trying to move in a new direction, and how does that fit with that past history of whaling?
Well, Heather, we already have an extensive historical data collection in our logbook selection. We have over 2,700 logbooks in our library. And the whalers of the 19th century took incredibly detailed records of their of their expeditions, and they wanted to know where the whales were when they went back. They wanted to plan their next voyage. They wanted to know exactly where the climate changes were, you know, where there were glaciers, where there weren't, where there were sperm whales, where there weren't, so they could plan their next up to 4-year voyage at sea as efficiently as possible. So those resources are already being data mined for climate change studies and whale population studies now. So where there might have been glaciers at one time and there aren't anymore, or where there used to be a lot of sperm whales and there no longer are those same density of populations. So that's already studies that have been done on our historical resources. So the Watkins Collection really only serves to amplify that, huh? And it's another
oh boy, bad jokes source, already.
I know, well done. Another source of historical data. So we already, and Peter will speak to this more specifically, but there are scientists now who are using data from the 50s to compare with frequencies of 2014 and seeing how whale behaviors have changed to compensate for noise pollution. So one of the things that I'm most interested with the Watkins Collection is we have no idea of the application of this material in the future. The whalers had no clue that their logbooks might be used for climate change studies. And in 100 years, who knows what the Watkins Collection, what the capacity of that collection to tell us about the past of whales and underwater sound will tell us. But our mission of the museum is to talk about man's relationship to whales over time. So this is certainly in line with our mission moving forward.
Peter Tyak, you've made it. Congratulations.
<Thank you. laughs>
Made it through the traffic. Welcome. Last year, I had the opportunity to sail aboard the Charles W. Morgan, the world's last wooden whaling ship. I was out there on a trip to Stellwagen Bank National Marine Sanctuary with scientists and conservationists. And the message I took away from the day is not that conservation is making up for whaling, but that somehow, as Christina was kind of alluding to, that the research and conservation that we do today on whales is just kind of an evolution of our relationship with these animals. Do you see any irony in putting the world's largest collection of whale sounds in a whaling museum, or do you see these connections between whaling and research today?
Well, I definitely see the connection. So in the last century, where one of the greatest threats to whales was humans killing whales, one of the ways we managed those populations was to count the numbers we killed. And that was a very important way to manage populations, ideally to make sure too many were not taken, that the ideal wasn't always met. But today I think we need to recognize that marine life faces a whole new set of threats. As we reduce intentional killing of animals, as hopefully we reduce incidental mortality of marine mammals in fishing gear, we still are industrializing the ocean. So there's a whole new set of threats from climate change, pollution, chemical pollution, and noise pollution is another issue which we've realized over the last few decades may also really form a kind of threat for these animals in combination with all of the other ways we're changing the ocean. So I think that it's very important to keep a steady record of the status of the ocean, whether it's in terms of the chemical pollution and even noise pollution. So recordings of the sort that Watkins made are very, very useful to get an idea of what the baseline was. We don't know what the pre-industrial ocean sounded like, but we've noticed significant changes just over the last few decades.
Would you say, with all of those threats that you just mentioned facing whales and other marine mammals, are we still, in essence, whaling, but just in ways that are perhaps easier to ignore or put out of our mind than someone going out with a commercial whaling ship?
Absolutely. So locally, we need to worry about things like whales being entangled in fishing gear. From a animal welfare perspective, whaling was in some ways probably more humane than having an animal entangle in gear and have to drag it around for weeks, not being able to perform its normal activities.
And I think I was just reading a story last week about whales off the West Coast that have no tail flukes, that their tail has literally been amputated by fishing gear, and somehow they're surviving doing some sort of corkscrew swimming and diving and still managing, but they have no tail.
So I think we have a responsibility to modify the way we fish in order to reduce that risk. But we also have to be very aware that there are lots of unintentional consequences of putting CO2 into the atmosphere, of dumping chemical pollutants into the ocean, and also putting noise into the ocean. That's a form of energy that interferes with the capabilities of marine mammals that use sound in the ocean to explore their environment, to communicate with each other.
In case you're just joining us, we're talking today about the William Watkins Collection of Marine Mammal Sounds, which the New Bedford Whaling Museum has taken on. My guests are marine biologist Peter Tyack, curator Christina Connett, and museum science director Robert Rocha. Now, Robert, the William Watkins Collection is the most comprehensive assemblage of marine mammal sounds in the world. How many species, how many recordings, what are we talking about in terms of the size of this collection?
I know that I want to say there's probably 70 first-time recordings of any kind of species, and I'm forgetting the term used for a first time.
Like a voucher.
Thank you. Voucher. I was thinking quota.
I mean, so it's essentially like as you say, a voucher, but kind of a collection specimen, right? But in acoustic terms.
This comes from the early ideas of, a zoological museum that you would keep a voucher specimen of a species. This is keeping a voucher recording of the sound of a species.
Yes, and how many are we talking about here? Hundreds? Thousands?
Well, there are about 20,000 digitized at this point, but there are hundreds of thousands.
20, and that might only be 20,000 cuts that are digitized as opposed to all the innumerable full files.
Right, and one of the reasons that the museum is taking on the collection is there's a lot of physical material as well as digital. So the reel-to-reel tapes, the VHS, it's really the history of audio recording in marine mammal studies. So it's really covers the gamut of what Bill Watkins and Bill Chaville had to invent to gather this information on every kind of media that was available at the time. So the physical repository is a major part of it.
Peter, who was William Watkins? Tell us a little bit about him as a man and as a scientist. What is his legacy?
Yes. Well, let me start, if you will, with what I think of as the origin of marine mammal bioacoustics. It came serendipitously out of World War II. In the 30s, oceanographers at Woods Hole developed a bathothermograph, an instrument that ended up during the war being useful for countering submarine warfare. So submariners could use this to protect themselves. And Bill Chaville and Alan Vine would ride submarines during the war.
And Alan Vine being the inventor of Alvin,
exactly.
The submersible.
Yes.
So he was also doing acoustics.
So again, these very unusual combinations of very creative people. When they weren't helping the submariners with this bathythermograph, they loved sitting in the sonar shack and listening to the sounds coming out of the ocean. This was really the first time that humans, because our ears aren't well adapted to listening underwater, could hear the sounds of the sea. And after the war, grateful people in the Navy, as they were forming federal funding for science, asked oceanographers what they were most interested in doing because their research had been so useful for the war effort. And Chaville said, I want to find out what all of those sounds were. Nobody knew what was there. It was complete exploration. Nobody was trained for this. And he was forced to rely primarily on equipment from the military in the first years. And the great gift that Bill Watkins provided was he was hired at HUI in the late 50s to be able to build recording gear specifically designed for field work with marine mammals. He had worked with transistors. In those days, people were building electronics with vacuum tubes. And he built the first portable field recorder that you could take out in a small boat to be close enough to an animal to be sure, oh yes, it was that seal that made the sound. That's how they obtained these voucher specimens, was that they were, instead of being in a huge ship far from animals, potentially disturbing them, they were able to get close in good field settings and use these portable electronics in order to make recordings. It's a little hard for us to imagine these days where you could record on your iPhone how much equipment, how much weight, how much money it took to be able to do this kind of work. And I think of Bill Watkins as really the person who started our transition into the modern world now, where it's so easy to do this kind of acoustic research.
Well, one of the things I think is so interesting, and correct me if I'm wrong, but with this audio world, is whales will hide by going silent, or in a terrestrial world, it's like a squirrel, you'd freeze. And so to approach them with some measure of stealth to be able to record them without disturbing their normal pattern must have been a major challenge for them, too.
Yes, and so one of the other really interesting things about Bill Watkins is he grew up in Africa and had a real naturalist sense of how to approach animals, how to observe animals. And that, coupled with his electronics expertise, I think was critical to even know what to build, how to build the right kind of instruments and how to approach animals to make measurements that didn't disturb them and were able to really record natural behavior.
As you've alluded to, he spent his whole career recording, or most of his career, recording whales, built up this enormous collection. And before he died, there's an interview that was done with, I believe, someone from the Whaling Museum, where he talked about wanting to share this library that he had built up with the world. We've actually got a clip of that. Let's hear him.
What I would like to see happen, I would like to have the accumulated knowledge and historical understanding of what we have be translated into a marine sound archive that includes not only the animal sounds but all of the various geophysical sounds, swallow float sounds, all the data that we've had over the years on multiple sound paths and that sort of thing. It'd be very easy to bring in and include, and it would suddenly translate a library that's wonderful for me into something that would be wonderful for everybody else.
I love that clip because I think every scientist, by the end of their career, is sitting on some sort of treasure trove. I mean, they've spent their whole life dedicated to discovery. But most scientists aren't sitting around at the end of their career figuring out how to turn that into a collection, a library to be shared with the whole world. What went into, I mean, you helped Peter develop this collection. What went into turning what was his career into something that might be a museum collection?
Yes, this was an enormous decadal effort, taking thousands of tape recordings in lots of different media and being able to get all the associated data, field notes, why were they sure which species it was, and getting it all organized in a digital format so that you could link recordings to all of this metadata. I don't think people were using the term metadata to describe this in 1990, but Bill was very carefully organizing his life's work in order to make this possible. So he and many people in his lab spent a lot of time being able to gather all this material, get the field notes organized so that anybody could look at it and get the same kinds of information that he had in his head.
That's marine biologist Peter Tyak of the University of St. Andrews. Also with me here in our Woods Hole studio, Christina Connett and Robert Rocha of the New Bedford Whaling Museum. I'm Heather Goldstone. Up next, we'll listen to a small sampling of what the William Watkins Collection has to offer. We also want to hear from you. Our toll-free phone number is 866-999-4626. More Living Lab after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. What could scientists learn from more than 50 years' worth of recordings of whales, dolphins, and seals? And could any of that be of interest to the public? That's what we're about to dig into. My guests today are Robert Rocha, Director of Science Programs at the New Bedford Whaling Museum, Christina Connett, the museum's curator and exhibitions and collections, and Peter Tyak, Professor of Biology at the Scottish Ocean Institute and the University of St. Andrews. Peter Tyak, as we were just mentioning, you helped shape the life's work of Dr. Bill Watkins into a collection that the New Bedford Whaling Museum has now taken on. It's the most comprehensive assemblage of marine mammal sounds in the world, including some of the earliest recordings. Tell us about those really early days. What was the first marine mammal recording that we know of, at least?
Bill Scheville, right after the World War II, was very interested in trying to find places to study marine mammals near New England, and he heard that beluga whales were common in the St. Lawrence up in Canada. So he and his wife, Barbara Lawrence, who was curator of mammals at Harvard, borrowed a dictaphone, a very primitive device just for poorly recording speech, and an underwater microphone or hydrophone, drove up there and made the first recordings of any marine mammal I'm aware of, and published a paper in Science in 1949 describing this. This really, to me, marks the beginning of the science of marine mammal bioacoustics. But the recording sounds scratchy and terrible to our ears because the equipment was so primitive.
We don't have that early recording, but we have a nice modern recording of belugas in the St. Lawrence. Let's hear a few seconds of what they sound like. How novel or unexpected was it to hear these crazy sounds? I mean, they sound almost digital, not necessarily like they're coming from a living thing. To hear those coming from what you're pretty sure are whales under the water.
Yes, well, this was what was so interesting about the early days. Just discriminating interference from electronics or a cable rubbing on a boat from the sounds of an animal was a challenge. You're absolutely right. A lot of the sounds these animals make aren't what we would expect. It doesn't sound like terrestrial mammals. It doesn't sound like bird song. So this was part of the gift that both Chevelle and Watkins had of spending a lot of time and a lot of judgment working out what was the actual signal and what was noise coming from other sources.
Now, one of the, as you've alluded to, one of those early problems was determining what was making the sounds. That's still a problem. We're going to talk about some of the technologies that have developed to get around that. But there's another kind of story from early in this collection. Sonar operators in the 1950s described a series of clicks that they called a carpenter fish. It turned out it wasn't a fish at all. Let's take a listen. This is not one of the early recordings. Again, this is a modern recording, but of the same species. So let's hear this. I guess you could say that sounds like a lot of little tiny things banging hammers, for the carpenter fish idea. I have to say, I heard that, and my first thought was, it sounds exactly like if you've ever floated on your back on a coral reef, and it sounds like snapping shrimp. But in fact, it's a whale.
Yes, in the background, you were hearing static or something like snapping shrimp. It was the regular clicks that were the so-called carpenter fish. In the 50s, the people heard this sound all over. And when you got nearer animals, it did sound a lot more. You had more low frequency to the sound. It sounded more like hammering, say, on a roof. And I think you could hear there were several regular click patterns in there. And that sounded like several people regularly hammering. Each person had their own rhythm. Hmm. They were independent of each other. And it was a real mystery in the 50s what these were until Bill Chevelle and a physical oceanographer here at HUI had a sperm whale come very close to a hydrophone making exactly that sound. And again, in the late 50s, they were able to publish a paper showing that the carpenter fish wasn't a carpenter, it wasn't a fish, it was the sperm whale.
I guess for me, it just really highlighted the fact that you can't always see what's down below you. I mean, water may be clear, but when you put enough of it together, it's really hard to see what you're actually listening to. And it made me kind of question, oh, well, maybe I wasn't just hearing snapping shrimp. You know, maybe my assumptions were all wrong, too, about what I've heard when I've been in the water and just how hard it can be to make those connections well.
Yeah, so part of what's mind-bending about the lives of the deep-diving marine mammals like sperm whales is they lead a life that's really counterintuitive for a mammal. They will dive a kilometer below the sea surface, forage for food in the dark, in water that's a few degrees above freezing. And the way they do that is by producing these click sounds for echolocation, to listen for echoes from their prey. So the other problem for us floating around on a boat with a hydrophone dangling from the surface is that the animals actually are using these sounds a kilometer below us in the dark. So we are getting these signals from afar, and it makes it much harder to infer what the animals are doing.
That's marine biologist Peter Tyak. Also with me this morning, Christina Connett and Robert Rocha of the New Bedford Whaling Museum. We're talking about the William Watkins Collection, the most comprehensive assemblage of marine mammal sounds in the world. We'd like to hear from you. Our phone number is 866-999-4626. You can email us at livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. Christina Connett, in addition, as we've already kind of mentioned, there's just the sounds that are in this collection, but then there's also a whole lot of as you said, technology, the history of recording, and you're saying it's actually a couple of different collections, technically.
Yeah, the official names of the collections are the William A. Watkins Collection of Marine Mammal Sound Recordings and Data, which includes the recordings that we've been discussing, and also the William A. Watkins and William E. Chevelle Collection of Images and Instruments. And the second collection includes photographs of their process and of their experiences and also the actual instruments, because there weren't instruments to make these recordings to begin with. So they really were created by Watkins. So those actual instruments, many of them will be coming to the New Bedford Whaling Museum, including the harpoon tags and various other tools that they use to track these animals.
Well, Peter Tyak, tell us a little bit about how much the technology has evolved. You were talking about how big some of these original hydrophones and recording gear were, and we now have iPhones, and we've come up with ways to get around some of this what am I listening to by actually putting gear directly onto animals in the ocean. Talk about some of the changes we've seen in 50 years.
Yes, well, we should all be familiar with these changes in media for audio, from things like 8-track tape to cassette tapes to CDs, now to having it all online. That was amplified even more in the era I'm talking about. So among the work that Chaville did after using the dictaphone and needing to record low frequencies was they actually mastered direct to vinyl from ships, on Navy ships, in order to be able to get high enough quality recordings.
That's incredible.
And just imagine moving an entire recording studio into a ship to be able to make these kinds of recordings. Now, that was just a Herculean effort. Only something like the U.S. Navy would be able to take that to sea. But by the time Watkins came, he could make reel-to-reel tape recorders that could be battery-powered, that you could carry on a small boat. Like, they called it, actually, the rowboat recorder, because it allowed you to get in a small enough boat to approach animals without bothering them. But once Bill Watkins developed the rowboat recorder, he immediately recognized we can't localize sounds underwater very well, and you need to use multiple sensors to be able to do that. So one of the early developments that was very important was making a 4-hydrophone array that allowed you to use a computer to tell what direction a sound came from.
Why 4 instead of, we're used to thinking about triangulating. You might only need 3 to figure out where something's coming from.
Yes, well, most animals get away with just 2 ears and can have a pretty good sense of where a sound comes from, but they use a lot of context and a lot of brain power to do that. And if you really want to locate where a sound comes from in 3 dimensions, 4 hydrophones is the minimum you need just to solve the problem in as simple a way as possible.
All right, so fast forward a little bit. We're still talking about something that fits in a rowboat, not something the size of an iPhone. How much change have we seen in the decades after that?
Yes, that's the amazing period in the 90s. When digital electronics became small enough that you could start thinking about putting an audio recorder right on the animal. And again, working with engineers at Woods Hole, I worked closely myself with an engineer, Mark Johnson, here, who's very expert at designing this kind of digital circuitry to make a tag small enough that you could actually put them on initially a large whale, like a sperm whale or a humpback whale, and have it record the animal's own sounds for, say, up to a day. We would record so much data, we were memory limited and power limited, so we just would use suction cups to attach a tag temporarily onto the animal for up to a day at a time. And that allows you to really take an amazing ride following the life of an acoustic animal, say a sperm whale, diving down silently for a while, starting making its search clicks. They make an acceleration of clicks when they are trying to capture prey. You can follow second by second everything that the animal is doing. And with some of the species we work with, like beaked whales, you can actually record the echoes of prey from a whale foraging a kilometer below the sea surface in the dark and watch it approach. You can see how quickly it moves towards it. Sometimes you can watch the prey get away. Sometimes you can see the echo just disappear as the whale catches it.
You can literally experience echolocation for yourself.
Absolutely.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was completely unexpected. And I think this is one of the other things that's important to mention about the sense of wonder of this work. In the initial phases with Chaville and Watkins, the sense of wonder was, what could these sounds be? What species was making them? We now know most of that, but there's still this amazing sense of wonder and anticipation of the unexpected. When you put a tag on an animal for the first time, you have no idea what new kind of information will come up. We never would have predicted we would have detected echoes of prey from these animals.
You know, and following up on what Peter was just talking about, one of the other things that's been learned about beaked whales from these recordings is the fact that beaked whales will actually be quite quiet, top 500 meters or so, because they don't want to be heard by the orcas. You know, so the beaked whales need to use sound to feed, but they also would make themselves visible via sound to their predators. So they would actually wait till they get down about 500 meters, and then they would begin their echolocation to find their food. So they've actually learned a behavior, you know, and I guess they teach it to each other, you know, just to be quiet for a while so you don't get captured, and then you can go feed.
Sounds like Cold War submarine warfare. You've got your stealth cloaking device so nobody else hears you and finds you. And
everything about their behavior is cryptic. And it's, again, it's counterintuitive for an air-breathing mammal. But I think they're most comfortable in the dark, a kilometer below the sea surface. And every time they have to surface to breathe, they have this worry that their predators may be waiting up there.
When it comes to the allure and certainly public knowledge of whales, I think humpback whales have got a top all of them. I mean, you know, whale song recordings became really popular in the 70s. But there's one humpback whale recording in the collection that I want to play for you. It doesn't sound like any of those whale songs, but it really spoke to me for another reason. I'll tell you after we hear it.
Sperm whale.
Nope, that's the sperm whale. And that's the one that actually sounds like the hammer, isn't it? Here we go. Here's the humpback whale. So you get a little bit of that popular whale sound in there. But what I heard when I first listened to that recording was, that's a cow underwater. I mean, it sounded like mooing. And my next thought was, I'm hearing evolution because this is a cow underwater. And that's exactly what it sounds like.
Yes. So we think the baleen whales produce their sound with a larynx like terrestrial mammals. So there are more similarities than for the toothed whales, which produce their sounds with a completely different way. That first set of clicks that you heard before there probably did not sound like your average mammal, but it would sound more like a bat because both of them have evolved specialized mechanisms for echolocation.
How much, Christina and Robert, of this collection will be available to the public, and what kinds of lessons or information are you hoping people will take out of interacting with this collection of sounds?
Well, there are a couple ways we'll approach it. We've actually assembled an amazing advisory panel of marine mammal bioacoustic scientists, and they're guiding us on what are the most important stories for scientists in the future, how's the collection being used now professionally. But we also, there's all these wonderful stories to tell to the public, particularly the story of conservation with whales. Once people realize that these were complex mammals like us with complex social structures and communication, that's really one of the main reasons that whales took off as a conservation icon. So the history of conservation is fascinating in that way. We also want to talk about some links with human beings. There's some great lectures over the weekend at the New Bedford Whaling Museum in a HUI conference talking about bone conduction and how human beings experience this underwater just like pinnipeds do. And some human beings who are blind are actually learning echolocation and are managing to navigate with echolocation, which is fascinating. So some of these stories are just a way to get people to understand how close we actually are with whales and to get involved with some of these conservation issues moving forward. Certainly with the North Atlantic right whale and other species, the vulnerabilities that made them, or their biology that made them vulnerable to whalers are many of the same characteristics that make them vulnerable to entanglements and ship strikes, living very close to the surface, close to human activity, sort of easy to hit by a freighter moving into the Boston Harbor, for example. Two of our skeletons were killed by ship strikes at the museum. So it's a very relevant story for us. So we plan on making the collection as accessible as possible. We're free access, which is what Bill Watkins's intention was. So we'll make sure that it's as accessible as we can make it for public, students, and scientists moving forward.
Robert, any thoughts on the kinds of research? Are there projects already going on or the kinds of research that the museum might try to foster with this collection?
I think for us it's more about expanding the sensory experience people have when they come into the museum. I think occasionally we face a perception issue that the Whaling Museum is just going to be about dead whales and dead people, when in fact, you know, we tell a lot of very important stories, and one of those stories in the last few years has been the whales side of the story. And, to be able to add sound to that really makes the whales come alive. I mean, you can't help but be reminded that these are living, communicating, sentient creatures, but they just do it a little bit differently than we do. It's much more about sound than it is about visuals.
I want to play one last clip from the collection that, Robert, you actually pointed out to me. It's not a whale. This is actually a bearded seal. But when it comes to sounds that sound completely alien, even beyond the clicking, this sounds like sound effects from Star Trek. So let's hear this. This will definitely expand your repertoire of marine mammal sounds. Nope. All right. Maybe we don't have the bearded seals. It seems we've got the sperm whales instead of the bearded seals. We'll have to put that one on our website for you to hear. I mean, it's really incredible. And for me, one of the shocking things about it was I thought I knew what seals sound like. And again, you know, it sounds like whales are related to cows and they kind of make this mooing sound. And then we even call it barking in seals, right? They're related to dogs and we hear them above water and they bark. And then to hear the sounds that they make underwater that were just completely otherworldly was really, as you say, eye-opening. Completely expanded my horizons.
Yeah, a few years back, we had an exhibit that was a double of one that was up at the New England Aquarium. It was a Sounds in the Sea focused thing. And one of the clips we had on there was the bearded seal. And when I first started working at the museum, I played it a couple of times just to make sure. It's like, that sounds like a special effect from a science fiction movie, it, you know, or like a cartoon where this thing is falling out of the air and it makes it, you know, an increasingly loud whistling noise. And then when visitors would come in and they were, you know, over at this panel, I would say, no, play that one, play the bearded seal, you know, and, you know, they'd all get a giggle out of it and, you know, listen to other things too.
Yeah, but the capacity of this collection gives the museum to really improve visitor experience and educate visitors on the diversity of whales is enormous. I mean, we're just going to barely start scratching the surface in the next year, and I know that there's a lot more we're going to be able to do. But it's a very exciting acquisition for us, so we're thrilled.
That's Christina Connett of the New Bedford Whaling Museum, also with me, Robert Rocha, and marine biologist Peter Tyak. We are talking about the William Watkins Collection, the most comprehensive collection of whale sounds in the world. You can join our conversation by calling toll-free 866-999-4626 or emailing us livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. Living Lab continues after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking today with Peter Tyak, Christina Connett, and Robert Rocha about the William A. Watkins Collection of Marine Mammal Sounds, which the New Bedford Whaling Museum has taken on. Christina, we've touched on this a little bit, but how do you view this collection relative to the rest of the museum's holdings? I mean, you've talked about it kind of enhancing people's experience, but do you see this as I guess as a growing chapter of the museum and a direction that the museum will continue to go to have more of the modern scientific story of whale research and whale conservation at the museum?
I do, because I think it contextualizes the story of modern conservation to have this historical data like the Watkins Collection and our logbooks. I mean, the whalers were really some of the, if you think about it, some of the first real natural science observers of whales, because people either saw them dead on the beach or they saw a fluke off the side of the boat. And so there really wasn't much information to go on. If you look at drawings in natural science books in Europe, some of the whale species drawn in those books look like a cow compared to an alligator, compared to a whaler's drawing, because they knew what they actually looked like and they understood the anatomy. Likewise, fishermen today are some of the biggest helpers of science because they're out there on the field. They're seeing these animals out on the water and they're doing the counts because of their own interests, but at the same time, it's all working together. Just like Watkins and Chaville, actually, according to Peter, was telling me the other day, they actually did work with some commercial whalers to receive back some harpoons that had been sent off on, I guess, mostly blue whales and fin, or were they other species?
They tested their tags that they used to track whales in the Icelandic fishery.
Yeah, so I mean, they actually were helping out this scientific process. But I see that, you know, the whaling traditions actually inform a lot of modern conservation. And likewise with the Watkins and Chaville, this collection, as I mentioned, we don't even know the capacity of it, even for soundscapes and other applications besides just mammals.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. We had a listener, Naomi, emailed us and said that in response to us pointing out that the 20th century whaling still widespread and a major toll, Chances are I'm not the only listener who remembers whale meat offered on the menu of the old New Bedford Hotel. Never could bring myself to try it.
Yep, that's true. A few of our docents have commented on that. You know, they're a little bit older than I am, but they can recall going into that. I think the restaurant was called the Jolly Whaler, and there was whale steak on the menu.
Go ahead.
I was going to say that would have been through 1972 when that was the year that the Marine Mammal Protection Act was passed.
Right.
So, you know, that was the end of that item on the menu.
Yeah, so there was a famous dinner in the Museum of Natural History in New York that Delmonico's chef threw a dinner party in the basement, I guess, of the museum to try to promote whale meat in the first quarter of the 20th century in the U.S. And there's a wonderful paper written about this, but it was not terribly popular, thank goodness. So otherwise, perhaps it would be more normal for us to consider that as a source of protein.
So one of my hopes for this collection is that when on this topic, it's amazing to think about how radically our culture has changed in our perception of these animals.
And in a relatively short time. I mean, we're talking 1970 to 2015, going from a potential dinner item to animals that are really quite widely, I'd say almost revered.
Exactly. So I think it's wonderful for an institution like the Whaling Museum, whose mission is to look backwards and help explain the past, to capture while it's still fresh this transition. And I think much of the research had a lot to do with our change in perception of these animals. What we learned about their own lives was really critical for this change. So I think that this is a hope I have for the exhibit, is that it will help in the future explain to future generations how our culture performed this change.
Right. And I think that William Watkins is said to have given the voice to the whale, which I think is a huge start of conservation. I mean, that was really a key to realize, again, that these are complex animals with complex communication, very, very much like people. And one of our goals at the museum is for people to leave understanding what whales are, and not just that whaling happened in this pocket of time and now it's over except in a couple places, but there are things that are happening at this moment that they can actually take part in making solutions, like with entanglements and ship strikes. We have a giant, it's only an adolescent, but it's a huge blue whale skeleton in the center of the Jacobs Family Gallery. And as Bob mentioned, blue whales weren't caught by Yankee whalers. So this is really the first time we've had real context for that story, is that it was killed by a ship strike, and it now relates to the Watkins collection, and it gives a context to things we've actually had in the collection. It's really a fantastic way to start reinterpreting things we already have.
Peter, 50 years worth of recordings, as we've already touched on, the ocean has changed a lot in 50 years. One of the things that has changed is the noise level. How much of that is reflected, and the response of the whales to that is reflected and recorded in this collection?
Yes, well, I have an interesting story to tell about that. A PhD student of mine, Susan Parks, wrote her PhD thesis on the sounds of North Atlantic right whales today, the sounds that they make. She had made a lot of recordings. She was very familiar with the sounds of right whales. And she had heard that Bill Watkins had made recordings in 1956 when right whales were feeding right in Vineyard Sound, not so far away from here as we speak. And when she listened to the tapes, she went to Bill and said, "There's something wrong. The tapes must be going too slow because the sounds are so low in frequency." And Bill was very picky about his hardware, and he checked everything, and it was working just fine. And that stimulated a fascinating project. Susan then compared the sounds of right whales from the 50s in the North Atlantic to the modern day, and found that on average, the sounds are quite a bit higher in the modern day. And it turns out that shipping noise has slowly been increasing as we import more and more goods from abroad. We have more and more ships coming by, and that sound spreads over the entire global oceans and elevates the ambient noise and makes it quite difficult to communicate in the frequency range that right whales were communicating in the 50s. So basically, the entire population has switched from being basses to being tenors in order to shift out of this noise band.
Wow.
And we would never have known that if Bill hadn't saved these recordings and been cautious enough for us to make sure that actually that the frequencies were correct.
Right, making sure that you have all of the technical information to make sure that you can actually balance those against each other and
Exactly.
Know what you're hearing is technically correct. That's really amazing.
Well, yeah. One thing, too, to add to that is I went to Susan's lecture the other day. It was fantastic. That from the 50s until now, that's still within the lifespan of probably the same individuals. So they've had to change their behavior within their lifetime, and how much farther will they have the physical capacity to change as they continue to modify their behavior towards communication with noise rising rather than falling, which I think is quite fascinating as well.
Concerning, but fascinating.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Very concerning.
Luckily, they do have compensation mechanisms, like we have when you speak loudly when you're wearing a headphone. As it gets louder, animals will also elevate their voices, but that takes more energy. And so that's the question, is what's the point at which these compensation mechanisms become too costly, or you lose the ability to communicate with, say, a mother to keep contact with a calf over the range that they typically separate?
I think part of the reason that we've seen such a rapid transition in public attitude towards whales is the more we learn about them, the more we do begin to feel close to them, that we feel that they're intelligent animals, that we can somehow relate to their behavior. And Peter, your research in recent years has taken almost a philosophical bent, really looking into whale sounds as a form of language and what we can learn about that, and even asking the question, is there creativity? Do you think that whales possess creativity?
Yes, well, you were talking about humpback song earlier. I think most of us have heard humpback song, but there's been a fascinating research project off the east coast of Australia looking at how song changes. We know that humpback males learn their song because it slowly changes over a season, with all the whales within a population tracking those changes. And the biologists studying humpback song in eastern Australia recognized there were a set of islands stretching all the way across the South Pacific to French Polynesia. And they compared the recordings across these areas. And what they found was that there's something about the song off the east coast of Australia that seems to have value to the other whales. Those songs are slowly picked up by the next population to the east, and then gradually spread, so that you have sort of a cultural center for humpbacks in eastern Australia, which are originating slight new changes to the song. Those are picked up by whales all the way across the South Pacific, thousands of miles. But it takes so long that the ones in the Far East are a few years out of date. It's sort of like you have a cultural center which originates a musical style, and maybe the colonies are a few years behind.
It's a really slow-moving pop music fad.
Exactly.
I mean, Bill Watkins himself was an anthropologist, a linguist, knew dozens of African languages. Do you think maybe some of these bigger questions about the nature of whales and our connections to them were in the back of his mind as well as he was making these recordings?
I think there's a combination of things there. In the early days, people were very careful not to make cognitive interpretations of animal behavior. The behaviorist tradition was very strong in the 50s and 60s. And he also was very skeptical and careful about getting evidence. But that it certainly was part of what motivated his interest. His skills as a linguist were very high. And one of the fascinating things about marine mammals, both the seals and the whales, is that they learn to make new sounds. This is very rare among mammals. If your dog or cat hummed a tune you were humming or repeated back words, you would probably
be pretty shocked.
Surprised. Yeah. But I don't know how many of the listeners know about Hoover the talking seal. There was a seal at the New England Aquarium that actually imitated speech so precisely you could tell he had a New England accent. So just like the humpbacks
Incredible.
Learn their own songs, some of these animals can imitate speech like a parrot or a mynah might be able to. And this ability to imitate sounds, it's so important for our language and our music. But even our closest primate relatives do not have this skill. So I think we can learn a lot looking at the few mammals that have also evolved similar skills. And the marine mammals are very prominent among that small group.
So much to learn. Thank you all. Christina Connett is curator of exhibitions and collections at New Bedford Whaling Museum. Robert Rocha is the director of science programs there. And Peter Tayak is professor in the School of Biology and the Scottish Ocean Institute at University of St. Andrews. Congratulations on the William Watkins Collection and the symposium that you just wrapped up. Until next week, this is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.